Hi, and welcome back to the Mindful Sport Performance Podcast. I'm Dr. Keith Kaufman.
I'm Dr. Tim Pinot. And today we are thrilled to have with us Wesley Ng, the head women's rowing coach of University of Pennsylvania. Welcome, Wes. Thank you so much for being here.
Awesome. Tim, Keith, it's great to be with you today. And thanks for setting up some time to have a conversation.
Yeah. So I just want to take a moment to kind of share a little bit about you, just so you can sit uncomfortably while I just read off a bunch of amazing stats and accomplishments. But so, yeah. So Wes is the head coach for University of Pennsylvania's women's rowing team. He was the 2023 Ivy League and Collegiate Rowing Coaches Association, that's the CRCA, D1 Region 1 Coach of the Year. And since starting at Penn in 2015, he's led his team to some astonishing successes. Just a few of these accomplishments include leading his team to qualifying for the NCAA championships for the first time in program history for the past 2 years, Varsity 8 earning its first two medals in program history at the Ivy League championships. That was a silver in 2023 and bronze in 2018. Four of his athletes earning CRCA All-American honor and 49 athletes earning CRCA National Scholar Athlete recognitions. Wes has spent 4 years also on the coaching staff of the U.S. Under 23 national team. He was the head coach of the U.S. women's team at the 2015 and 2016 Under 23 World Rowing Championships. At these competitions, he led the U.S. to gold medals in the 8 twice, the 4, the Coxless 4, and the pair. Prior to these experiences, he was the head women's rowing coach at Trinity College in Hartford, Connecticut. I used to race Trinity, the men's team. I went to Tufts, so we can talk about that. Where his team qualified for the NCAA Division III championships all 9 years of his tenure. He also won the NCAA Division III title in 2014, and his Varsity 8 won the NCAA titles in 2008 and 2015. His experience with Trinity earned him the CRCA Division III Coach of the Year Award, the Eastern Collegiate Athletic Conference Coach of the Year, the Joy of Sculling Collegiate Coach of the Year, and the U.S. Rowing Fans Choice Collegiate Coach of the Year. And he is not without his own accomplishments as a rower, a 2002 Yale graduate with a bachelor's degree in history. Wes rowed for the Bulldogs lightweight crew. I was also a lightweight rower. And he was part of three Eastern Association of Rowing Colleges Sprint Championships, and he won the IRA as the Intercollegiate Rowing Association National Championships his senior year. He was part of three undefeated seasons in his freshman, junior varsity, and varsity 8 boats, and also rowed at the prestigious Henley Royal Regatta. He holds U.S. Rowing Association Level 3 Coaching Advanced Certification, and he's a member of the NCAA Division III's Rowing National Committee and the NCAA Regional Advisory Committee. Basically, Wes knows what he's talking about when it comes to rowing.
I'm really embarrassed by you sharing all of that.
And I know this is a podcast. He's literally blushing. We just have to say he's literally blushing, which we love.
a lot of accomplishments.
Yeah. It's funny that you say those things, because I feel like my approach to coaching is to not think about very much of the past, but to try and stay in the present as much as possible. So the past experiences seem to play less and less of a role rather than being more in the immediate moment. So
see, and this is why we wanted to talk to you. Yeah, what you just said, it's like, yes, this is great. I love
that. Yeah, well, and I think the inherent kind of like paradox or irony perhaps of this, like, right, this mindfulness based approach, like the less we hold on to that stuff and the less we strive towards the future, the more we are just here right now, the more accomplishments we kind of accrue, you know.
Totally agree. Yeah.
So
yeah.
I know we're going to get to the interview portion in just a sec, but I have a question for you. And I joked before we started recording that you guys are going to be speaking Rowan language, and I'm just going to be nodding and smiling throughout this, right? Like, and I'll try to bring in some useful mindfulness observations and everything. But in the rowing world, is there like the equivalent of an EGOT, right? Because here you've got Coach of the Year in Division I, Coach of the Year Division III. So if you go to a Division II school at some point and get Coach of the Year, what do they do? What is the honor that they give you for having all three levels Coach of the Year?
I can't imagine that there would be an honor. I think where my mind immediately jumped to was the challenge of that, in that, you know, each one of Division III, Division II, Division I are such different beasts in terms of what is required, that as soon as you put that challenge out there, I started thinking, my goodness, I wonder if I could figure that out, because yeah, it just,
well, I'm sorry, Penn. So I don't mean to already be trying to poach one of your great coaches here, but I was like, that seems pretty special that you get coach of the year across multiple NCAA divisions. I wonder how many coaches have achieved that. That's pretty amazing.
Well, yeah, I haven't looked that up, but I will say it's very humbling to be honored by your peers, because that's who is voting for those awards, and for them to see your crew get to those different levels and to do something worthy of recognition, it's very flattering.
Yeah, and I know, you know, like, the obviously we're going to talk a little bit about like the results, some of the results that I just mentioned, but I know you don't get those results without kind of really tending to the athlete as a whole, right? And I think that's a lot of what it means to probably be coach of the year, not just how your teams perform, but, you know, just how they are well-being wise, which we'll get there. But before we do that, we do like to start each of our episodes with a brief practice. And, you know, you were just talking about, you know, not thinking too much about the past, not striving too much ahead into the future. And that was actually the practice I wanted to share today. So I think one of the things that can come up when we're doing mindfulness training and you offer someone a meditation, you're asking them, you know, keep your attention focused here, maybe watch your breath and let go of thoughts. And I think immediately people, maybe athletes in particular, will take that as a directive to get thoughts out of their mind, to push thoughts away. And so this is a kind of a meditation where we can really kind of watch and hopefully feel the difference between letting a thought go versus pushing it away. So what I'm going to invite everyone to do, if it's available to you, to just pause wherever you are, standing, sitting. If you can close your eyes, that'd be wonderful. If you're driving, maybe do this later. And we're going to do a very kind of traditional, just a breathing meditation, except I'm going to throw some math problems in there. And what I'd like you to do is just not solve them. That's it. You'll hear the words, you'll hear the numbers, and just don't solve them. And I think there is a difference, and maybe you'll feel it, between hearing these words and not attaching to them, just letting them go and staying with your breath, versus actively trying to tell your brain, wait, don't do that, wait, don't do that, wait, don't do that. So we'll have this experience together and we'll see what it's like. So yeah, find a comfortable seat or standing position, somewhere where you can feel rooted, grounded, where you can allow some of the muscles in your body, muscles in your face, your shoulders, to relax, to let go. Bring your attention to your breath, finding some sensation. Maybe it's the feeling of the air flowing in and out of your nostrils. Or maybe it's the sensation of your belly or your chest expanding on the inhale, deflating on the exhale. And without trying to change anything, just seeing what happens to your breath when we slow down. To not force our breath to be full and deep, but to let our body breathe in whatever way it wants to right now. Finding that rhythm and simply watching the inhale all the way to the top of the inhale. Feeling that breath turn the corner and come around back down all the way to the bottom of the exhale. And allow your mind to return again and again to the sensations of the breath. And whatever thoughts arise, simply letting them go. 17 plus 24. Watch what your mind does. Just come back to the breath. Notice if some tension has arisen, some mental tension, maybe some physical tension. Notice any pull to find an answer. (110/7). These are just numbers, just words, processes that we ascribe meaning to. In reality, it's just a combination of sounds. But watch what the brain does. Watch the ways your mind attaches meaning. And watch the way that attachment pulls you into a process, perhaps pulls you away from the intention of simply being here with your breath. (27 × 14). Just sounds that can wash over you that need to have no bearing on where you choose to put your attention. Just see if you can notice that difference. If you do feel that pull to find an answer, notice that difference between telling your mind to stop versus ungripping, letting go, almost as if you're forgetting the numbers. And just returning to your breath. Let's take a few more breaths just like that. Following the inhale all the way to the top. Watching the exhale all the way to the bottom. And as we get ready to bring this meditation to a close, maybe wiggle your fingers and your toes. Feel some movement in your body. Let your attention gently return to the room around you. And when you feel ready, sit back, open your eyes. Super curious. Because like I have done this myself, like, because I've noticed this pull, but I don't think I've ever led someone through this. I'm really curious about your reaction.
Starting to say, didn't mean to talk over you, Tim. Thank you for leading that. Yeah, I've never participated in a meditation quite like this. I always love it when you throw something new out like this that I've never done before. It's very, very cool. I'm always thinking in part, you know, I'm trying to be present and do the meditation with you, and also thinking like, oh, this is neat. I want to try this in different ways. And wondered, like, you picked really challenging math problems. And if there was a reason, like, I think one of them was 110/3. And it's like, well, what if you would have said 110/2 and it was something I could do just like with the snap of a finger? Like, would that make it harder? Would that make it easier? You know, of course, you know, I had to let those thoughts go and okay, go come back to the breath. But that was where I went. It's like, ooh, I noticed that you picked something that wasn't actually divisible. And is that easier to let go? Is that harder to let go?
Yeah, no, I definitely did that on purpose. Because yeah, I mean, what I some of that like simple math, right? Our brain just knows it, you know, like and so it, in some ways, to me, that would almost kind of sidestep the intention of the meditation. Because like if the answer, right, enters into your awareness without effort, like there is really isn't like a kind of a letting go. And I think the letting go here is in the striving of like, what is 100? It was 110 divided by 7. Like, what is 110 divided by 7? You know, it's like, what is it if I carry the 3? You know, and it's like, oh, wait a second. No. Can I just let the, what if I just.
Oh, don't? That's funny. I remembered it as 100, as 3 because probably because in my head I was doing.
So I chose the slightly more challenging ones. Like it would require a little bit of effort, right? Require a little bit of that working memory to engage, you know, and to be like, huh. And to so give yourself, giving some space to catch yourself doing it and be like, can I let this go? Or am I like trying to stamp it down, push it away?
The last one was 27 by 14. Was that the multiplied by 14? Yeah. And I found myself wanting to really solve it. And, but then also thinking about the instructions and the attempt to not purposely stamp down my instinct and to kind of try to allow some dual purpose at the same time. So I it made me think, my goodness, as like it's just in the attempt is where there might be value, rather than the actual result. And also being able to not answer would be great. Like, that's really tough.
It is. I wonder too, and Wes, if you have an opinion on this, this wasn't a question we had planned to ask necessarily, but you know, doing an exercise like this may be especially tough for someone really high achieving, you know, someone who is, I mean, I so many of the athletes I work with, you know, I say this with love, are very perfectionistic, you know, and that it's really hard to let that go. And if it's kind of the flip side of some of what makes us so good at what we do, you know, to get to the level of coach that you are, I imagine you probably have some perfectionist tendencies of some kind, or not, maybe not. I don't mean to presume anything. And so, yeah, like, do you think there's anything to that?
I totally the idea of perfectionism resonates with me a lot because, for a long while through my coaching career, I felt like that wasn't something to be worried about. Why would it be? I couldn't even contemplate that trying to be perfect at whatever it is that you're doing, might have negative consequences. So even the learning of, my goodness, if we adjust that and let go some and try to find different ways to approach things, the outcomes are just infinitely better. And I tend to try to see that in my athletes now as well, just to pick up and like even encourage them to explore. Could this be something that is hurting your energy level, hurting your experience level, in addition to not getting it out of the way altogether, because there are really good benefits to it. And there are like in extrinsic rewards to some of those behaviors. But I find it really, when I encounter a kindred soul that also says like, well, what's the problem with that? I'm trying to be perfect. Isn't that exactly what you want me to be? And so I try to help people just consider that there might be another possibility.
Which can be so challenging for, I think, for athletes in particular. But I think we're at least here, like, you know, in America and Western culture, we're like really raised with this idea that perfect is an achievable goal. It's absolutely the thing we should be striving for. And I always come back to this, just like the context of education, where the way we are graded, you start at 100 and just points get taken off, right? Like from first grade, the expectation is perfect. 100 should be achievable, right? Like it's drilled into us. And so I do think it requires sometimes like a pretty intentional and even effortful kind of take from someone like a coach or an authority figure to show a different way. And I think it really has to be kind of embodied and taught. And that's a great segue and kind of like the first question I wanted to ask you. I mean, and this kind of came through in your bio, just the consistency of these kind of really amazing results of the teams that you've coached, you know, across divisions, like you said, very different beasts. You know, I know, having been a rower, right? Like I know how hard it is to perform that consistently at these levels. And so I'm so curious to ask you, like, how do you help your athletes not burn out? I mean, how do you introduce this idea to them that, you know what, this striving to be perfect, right, really isn't kind of going to be your route to success because it's not sustainable. Like, what's your philosophy when it comes to coaching the, you know, the whole person, not just a body that is a machine that takes strokes, you know?
It's interesting that you asked that question of like, how does it happen? And it's forcing me to go through some of the most formative experiences that I remember. And I'll start with my own athletic experience where we were very used to winning races. I was very fortunate to have some amazing teammates that were very skilled. And two of them approached the sport in completely different ways. So one of them was the high intensity, high excitement, just, you know, almost you could imagine him rowing with a helmet on. That would be the way he would approach it. And then there was a much more cerebral and mental flow, almost like a yoga practice was the way that he would approach it. And these two guys coexisted and were nearly unbeatable. And I was lucky enough to row with them. And seeing how they both would have to funnel their energy into rowing right next to one another, despite having diametrically opposed approaches to the sport, really that spoke to me that this can happen in different ways as long as when we put our energies together, we're aligned in one goal. The next piece of that was like at the end of my senior year where we were very fortunate to win the national championship, I felt like an overwhelming sense of relief. I don't think I necessarily felt joy, which kind of surprised me as time went on, as I reflected on that, because it should be a joyful experience. This was the culmination of a four-year career with some of my best friends, with a coach who I trusted and continue to trust implicitly. And it shouldn't feel like relief. It should probably feel more like the starburst of joy. And so that was kind of the prism that I went through and began to help the other athletes that I had the good fortune of coaching, in that it was, what approach do you take to the sport? I have to learn who you are. What makes you tick? What makes you potentially more successful? Are you a high intensity person? Are you a high, internal concentration type athlete? And is there a way for us to not only experience excellence, but also to experience joy on a daily basis? Like, it shouldn't just be the result at the end that makes you feel like everything was worth it. And I think that's the component of like, if you enjoy it every day, then the likelihood of the end result being better is of course going to be higher. And it shouldn't feel like an exercise of willpower all the time to do the things that in our sport should feel good. So I've tried to tease that apart over time. And almost serendipitously, there were these moments when different coaches would come into my, or I would fall into their orbit because they were, you know, my mentor coaches. And many of them had a deep educational background. One particular, Larry Gluckman, his master's was in special education. And so how do you teach the sport in such a way that matches up with the most accessible educational experience? And if we can do that, then all of the life lessons from the sport become much easier to observe. So, I mean, those are little things. Like if we try and approach it more from an educational background rather than a pure competitive sport background, I felt like that eased some of the tension and allowed rowers to flourish more. So long-winded way of trying to answer your question there. But yeah.
I want to ask two quick follow. Sorry, Tim. Yeah, no, just want to ask just two quick follow-ups on that, which I think are related. And I'm not asking for you to disclose anything that would be like a trade secret or, you know, anything like that. But like, I wonder how much that informs recruiting in terms of like, you're talking about different styles and the combinations, I guess, now in your current role of women that you want, you know, what you're looking at. And then how you introduce this idea, this philosophy that you just shared, probably to a group of very high achieving young women who are used to thinking that willpower is the way. So
the recruiting side is big, because we tend to want to know people more deeply, and that can be both an advantage and a disadvantage, because it's uncomfortable to generate a closer relationship with somebody where they feel like they need to share more earlier. But the advantage to that is to see whether or not this might resonate with them. And we will often say that the people that right now in our group that maybe don't do so well in our program are ones that just want to be told what to do. We're looking for people that really want to explore more of and consider, could there be a better way? And who wanted to be more of a comprehensive experience where you could be at home and have those thoughts running through your head about how to do this thing better. And that being something we want to encourage, but in a healthy way, not in a ruminating and, you know, anxiety inducing way. I think that the other component of this, like I've tried to put this into practice. I was fortunate at Trinity College to teach a freshman seminar where we did it was called Food, Fitness, and the Journey Towards Self-Discovery. Like, what a liberal arts title, right? And we had these first-year students who would work out together. I would run them through a fitness class, and then we'd immediately go into the classroom, sometimes without showering, without anything, and go into a writing-specific or a theoretical reading assignment. And it was amazing to see how the barriers were broken down between these people, and how they would cooperate more. They felt like a team approaching academics. Mm-hmm. And that in turn allowed, you know, I remember it was a first year quarterback and a young woman whose most athletic experience was playing the flute, and they were doing burpees together, you know, and then immediately going and debating stuff about Dante's Inferno. It was incredible. So I think there is this connection between education and athletics that we can explore more.
Yeah. Well, yeah, this piece that you're describing, right? Because like there's the what to coach, right? Do I know the technique? Do I know the skill sets? You know, can I create a good periodization plan to, like, for the physical fitness? But then there's the how to coach. Like, how do I communicate this stuff in a way that's going to resonate, that's going to meet people? And I think embedded in your response, this appreciation or even this respect for individual differences, right? Feels to me like so rooted in acceptance, because I feel like often a coach, like, they come in and they're going to have like their way, and everyone's got to do their way. You know, I remember when I started, my coach in high school was this guy from, you know, from Ukraine. He was like very Eastern European style of rowing. My coach in college was an American guy. And when I, like, my first week at college, he was like, "You row wrong." And I was like, "I row wrong. I won a lot of medals." But I didn't row his way, you know? And of course, when you're in an eight, it's like, everyone's got to row the same way. Totally. But that idea of like, nope, we're going to train this way. We're going to think this way. And for you to create this space for like, okay, you can think this way and you can think that way. And like, we're going to find the strength in all of these ways, right? That you are going to be in charge of discovering what way works best for you. And then we're all going to pour that energy into our common goal. Like, that to me, it just like requires so much trust that like, oh, all these pieces will come together. Like, it'll be cool. It'll be all right. Like, it really is. You got to let go, I think, a lot of that desire to control. Though I guess I should ask you, like, does that resonate? Does that feel true?
I wish I could have recorded. Well, I guess we are recording this, so you said it far more succinctly than I do. But that is exactly it. Is that the each person going a little bit more both comfortably and in some ways even happier. I really feel, I don't remember who said this to me, but happier people learn better. Mm-hmm. And that idea of deep learning allows for each individual, because rowing in its nutshell is a repetitive motion that has very few ambiguities about it. Like, we know exactly what we're doing and it's repetitive and we should be able to do this thing better. So it's a sport of movement patterns and sequences. And if you can learn those better and learn them with more automaticity, then what we find out, the uncertainty around the end result is like that comes way down. All we need to do is do what we do at the best of our ability. So whatever we can do to maximize that is what I aim for. And one of the things about in rowing, and this is maybe, and Taylor, feel free to get rid of this part, is rigging, right? The idea of rigging a boat for each individual, we would have no problem indicating that that is the correct thing. Just like you would wear the right size shoe or the right size skates for a person to skate, why wouldn't we tailor a mental approach or a environmental approach that allows for more intimacy and more happiness with what it is that we're doing? I really do believe that rowing is hard enough that we don't need to make it harder for athletes, and making it a more challenging crucible is not really the way to go. I don't think that's especially not in the modern world, the more we learn about how people can improve.
Yeah. I don't want to ask Taylor to cut that piece out, because I think that's great. And you know, Taylor, of course, Taylor Brown is our producer. He's also one of your colleagues at Penn. And it's funny you invoke Taylor, because he had mentioned something. You know, we're trying a slightly different format for part of our podcast this season, where we're interviewing guests like yourself, but we're also doing these sort of roundtable discussions with Tim and Taylor and myself on different topics that we find compelling, and we hope our listeners find compelling. And one of the ones that we released earlier this season, we kind of talked about how Taylor has had this unique perspective in being both a mental performance consultant and also a coach. And one of the things that he said was, in the coaching role, in some ways it's harder to let go. You know, you have a little bit more skin in the game than when you're coming in as a consultant, and it's just a different perspective. And I'm struck by Tim saying, you know, it requires a certain amount of trust, and how much what he said seemed to resonate with you, Wes. And it's, you know, again, we read all the accolades. I don't mean to embarrass you again and go through all the different things that we said, but you're clearly a very accomplished coach. And yet you're saying one of the keys is to almost, like, for you as the coach to be able to let go, for you as the coach to not come in and say, I need to defend these accolades, I need to defend my job security and make sure that everybody's going with the program, right? You're almost saying it from the opposite perspective, that I need to make my presence smaller in a way because I want to customize what's happening to the athletes. Is that fair?
I think it is. And it links up with a thought of, and again, I believe this is a Buddhist thought, that when the student is ready, the teacher will come. Mm-hmm. And the teacher will appear.
Yeah.
And if the environment that we create doesn't allow there to be a person that you want to learn from, whether or not it's a teammate, whether or not it's a past coach or your own past self from a different sporting experience, or me, then, you know, we haven't really done a great job for that. And I think we all feel this in the coaching world, where we're all doing things that are relatively similar. And at the NCAA level, it's very fair. So we have rules that indicate that we only have 20 hours a week to actually train. So most of what we do, everyone kind of knows, but the student's response to what it is that we're doing is what is most important. So it's almost less about the lesson and more about how their response to the lesson is. I'm also really struck by trying to get folks to allow for pattern recognition. And that's one of the benefits that I have of having coached for a number of years and at different levels, is that I may not come to a better answer or a right answer, but my range of answers might be a little bit narrower. So I can help you not necessarily get past the challenge, but maybe give you three or four different ways to approach it. And so it's not 40 different ways to approach it. And that can be a little bit of an energy saver. And then also, I think for my coaching, I tend to look more towards asking questions rather than trying to anticipate and run over somebody and provide answers immediately. So one of our favorite questions is like, what are you working on? And allowing the athlete to describe that. And if they don't know what they're working on, that indicates to me that I need to do a better job of helping communicate what is the purpose of this next, you know, 40 minutes, 90 minutes, or this whole week of training. So that we could delve into a little bit more too, of you know, giving people the a narrower focus to get to something.
I love that answer. And I just have to say really quick as an aside, I don't know that I've ever heard a coach at your level use the word allow like that. I mean, that just blew my mind. I mean, you said a lot of great stuff there. Don't get me wrong. It's not like I just hung on that one word. I was listening to everything you said, but I was like, oh my gosh, he just said, allow them to learn the movement pattern. And I mean, I think that really embodies exactly what I was asking you about in terms of your ability to let go, because I would imagine, especially a younger coach, especially somebody who feels like they have something to prove, that they want to make sure that the athletes learn the pattern, right? That they want to impose a certain vision of what it has to be. And for you to speak about maybe the trust in your own skill set and what you've been through, and like you said, being able to narrow the playing field for them a little bit, but also the trust that you're showing in your athletes by allowing them to figure this out, I don't know that I've heard many high-level coaches speak that way at all.
This might be my own naive nature, but it seems very, I don't know if I could figure out a way to do it differently, because I don't necessarily have confidence in myself to know exactly what needs to happen all the time for this not to be a collaborative experience. That's really where, you know, I think it works for me in that regard. I do know also from being a lightweight rower in the back in and never being necessarily the most talented or the strongest, but I did feel like I could concentrate for a really long time, is that that allowed me to look for more different ways to train without necessarily training. So visualization very early on, and some mental tricks to know what I was preparing for. I was trying to tell a story to the athletes the other day that I had a French section that meant every morning and between 8 and 9 o'clock, my first year in college. And our championship was going to be, I believe, at like 8:12 in the morning. So my alarm would go off starting in September at 8:12. All the way for a race that wasn't going to happen until May 15th, to the point where, you know, like a watch beeping in class was very annoying. And yet at the end of the year, all of my classmates were like, hey, good luck at the championship. They knew exactly what was happening because they had all been brought into this 8:12 in the morning beeping that was going on. And even our French section teacher said the same thing. But like, that's nothing that requires athletic talent. That just was, and nobody ever told me to do that. That was just kind of the creativity of, huh, you know, it would take me 5 seconds to think about why is this watch beeping? Because it was important to me, what we were looking for at the end. So I think there are all those elements, and those are just free for everyone who wants to improve their performance without a high cost. I don't know if that story is at all interesting, but
yes, I love yeah. That story, you know, because I think it's, well, it speaks to something that that I think about a lot, which is like, you know, reflecting on my own kind of rowing career. I think similarly, I like when I was a rower in high school and in college, it was well before I really leaned into mindfulness. But when I look back, I know that I was in some ways practicing mindfulness, and I just kind of found it naturally. And I think about like you're saying, like things are free. They're just there. But what about the people that are so stuck in that? Just tell me what to do. I want to do it perfectly. I just got to do it right. I'm focused on the physical, right? Who need to be introduced to some of this stuff, who never get to take advantage of this stuff that is just there, that is just available. right? Because there isn't, and I think it's better now, like this really wide availability of mental training. So I'm actually really curious, like, given the fact that you've had these experiences yourself, like, how do you incorporate that in your coaching now? I mean, with the results that you have, clearly you've got the physical training piece down, right? But like, are there regimented or routinized ways that you introduce some of these like mental training approaches to your athletes?
I think, well, yes, we are purposely trying to introduce them to certain things. One of the things that Taylor observed was, prior to starting most of our sessions, we're trying to create a physical and mental gap between their lives on campus to when they arrive at the boathouse. So there is this 3 to 5 minute window where we'll either do something similar to the exercise that we did at the beginning of this, where it might be something guided. It could be something only about focusing on the breath. It could be visualizing what we're going to do in practice that day. It could mean at some points we even do some physical touch. So it could be, sitting back to back with a person that you're going to row with so you can feel their breath, or putting a hand on somebody's shoulder so you can feel the vertical change when people breathe in that way. Because in rowing, we are, even though we're very connected by the boat and we're supposed to do things together, we rarely are ever touching another person. And if we are, it's something's generally, going very wrong in the boat. But those little tiny connection points can, again, we're ritualizing the moment of coming in and being ready to perform. And also recognizing that we can also do a mental inventory of, hey, what feels different for me today than when it feels easy or when it feels excited or when it's a high stress moment or not. So I think just that very small investment of time allows for a lot of different things to occur. I think the other component is also asking people individually to consider how would they coach themselves. Mm-hmm. I'm struck by this phrase of giving the work back to the people. And so like, if you're really having a hard time with that, try to, or with something that I'm doing, maybe if that's something that you could explore yourself, because I very freely admit my faults to our group all the time. Like I may not have had anywhere close to the right answer, or what I'm saying may not resonate at all with you, but that doesn't mean that this isn't an area where we can explore for something good to happen. So we'll often ask people within our groups, and we do have loose training groups within our 50 to 60 athletes. Like, what are we learning in all three groups? Is there anything that we can share? What's working? What isn't working? So that we're increasing that the velocity of learning, and that they're hearing it from a peer rather than a perceived authority figure. Because what they say to one another is far more important than anything that I say to them. So again, that's little tiny things like that. That's more, in my mind, that's structural. That's not necessarily, content based, but we'll deal with that stuff as it comes up. So if something very interesting comes from our group that is just learning, I try to point that out and ask that person to expand on it for everyone else.
I feel like what you're speaking to is the importance, and we try to really emphasize this in like the MSPE work that we do, like the importance of integration, right? This isn't a thing we're adding on. This is part of what we do. This is part of how we row, right? Because it's not just what we do in the boat. It's how we approach practice. It's how we communicate with each other. Like all of that is part of our rowing, right? All of that is part of our training. And I think that mindset is so powerful because it opens the kinds of doors. We're like, oh, I could be training in French class, right? That could be part of my training. But, I also find myself thinking about kind of the flip side of that, and I think this is true for a lot of D1 sports, but I know, and I was a D3 rower. I think it's true for rowing just generally because of the rigor, because of the intensity, because more often than not, it's early morning practices. I mean, it's not just training. It's a lifestyle. I mean, it can be all consuming. And I mean, I'm sure this is the same for you. Like, I know my 2K score. It's been 15, 20 years. You know what I mean? But I know it. You know, that's like seared into me like my childhood phone number. You know, it's a thing I'm never going to forget. That's how integrated into the identity it is. And yet, at least that practice you were talking about of like, okay, you were just away from practice and now you're at practice. We need to separate those things. Implicit in that is this is only part of your identity. This is only part of what you do. You're in fact a whole person. And so knowing how all consuming rowing in particular can be, I guess I was curious to get your take on like, I don't know, the importance of promoting for your athletes that like, no, this is only part of your life, or this is only part of who you are as a person. You're not your 2K score. You're not your seat in the boat. And like, what, if any ways, do you actively promote that, like allowing them to not just be rowers?
You're touching on something that I really want to look at more and study more deeply. I'm not inherently a spiritual person, but I did hear one of the a guy who's very spiritual, one of a phenomenal athlete, Ryan Hall, who is I believe he's the U.S. half marathon record holder, a multi-time Olympian, you know, phenomenal athlete. And he talked about how his faith allowed him to really say to himself, like, hey, I am enough. I am enough without necessarily reaching all of these other goals that he had, which he's very capable of accomplishing. And in, I think that there is some fear from a coaching-based standpoint where if you were to say to somebody, especially in rowing or in another sports endurance sport, or sorry, strength endurance sport that requires people to suffer, to say, you won't be enough unless you do this. That is something that I think people wield almost as a means of like motivation, or they imagine this to be a way to motivate people that you must do this
directly. I think you're absolutely right. Yeah.
So it was, I came and I remember saying this very explicitly to people in the first year that we made the NCAAs, that like, you are enough if we do not do this. Like, you will be you are still going to be an amazing daughter. You are still going to be somebody's sister. You are still going to be somebody's friend. All of those things, your ability to impact life. Like, we are enough without this. And I was frankly afraid to say it because I wondered what impact could that have on somebody? But I don't think it's wrong. I think it should be on all of us as coaches not to use the most blunt instrument or the most blunt cudgel to get more out of people, but to look for ways to get that coming from a better place, not out of fear, but out of, again, joy and competency and all of those things. So, yeah, but feeling like you are enough if this doesn't. And so one of the things that we'll also do is look at what are the range of outcomes here? Within reason, right? Like, not like a meteor is going to hit the boat and like, that's not an outcome, but to say, hey, if things are go absolutely the worst possible for us in this race or in this training session, what is the actual outcome? And when you start to really define what that looks like, it's not that bad. It's really not that bad. It's not something that we can't bounce back from. And even if it goes phenomenally well and it's incredible, the very likelihood is that we're coming back to train the next day with, you know, some more confidence or whatnot. So we'll talk about those things fairly regularly. But yeah, I think that idea of like, you are enough without this, is still what scares me to say it right now.
I mean, it's amazing. And unfortunately, we have to wrap up our conversation because of where we are in our schedule. But man, I mean, I know I said earlier, I had never heard a coach say allow. And just as you're speaking to this, to hear the absence of fear in your approach and how, you know, these words like things that Tim and I talk about all the time on this podcast, how so many people feel like they need to rely on willpower, they need to rely on fear, they need to rely on intimidation, this feeling of not good enough to cause them to strive, right? How so much of that is baked into our system of sports, and how, you know, here we have this incredibly successful coach on our podcast essentially telling us that he has the exact opposite philosophy from that, and look how much he wins. You know, I mean, it's, and again, I mean, I'm not trying to emphasize the winning. I mean, even you've made it clear in this, in our discussion, that that's not what you're about, but it's the ultimate in process leading to outcome, right? It's the ultimate in how do we treat people? How do we treat ourselves? How do we nurture ourselves? How do we invite people to experience, to learn? And how it's that effort that ultimately actually probably leads to more success. That trying to manufacture that success, trying to force that success, trying to inspire that success through fear, intimidation, the things that so many leaders in our world do, it's a poison pill. It's not that you can't necessarily get there. There are people who are very successful going that way. But you said this earlier as well, Wes, like at what cost? Right? Like the huge cost that's associated with that. And I meant to just wrap up in about a sentence or two. I realize I'm going on here, but I can't say enough about how refreshing it's been to hear your perspectives. And I have to say, in all seriousness too, Tim, I don't know if this is your experience. Like, I don't know that we've ever had a better podcast voice. And I guess you have the greatest podcast voice, Wes. Oh my gosh. If any of our listeners are thinking that too, just as you're talking, like, my gosh, this guy could be like a broadcaster. He's amazing. But I hope you are willing to come back on and talk to us more, because I don't know about you, Tim. I got like a million more questions and I could listen to you talk all day. Thank you. Really. Thank you so much for sharing this. And, I feel like it is so much more powerful. You know, Tim and I beat this drum all the time, but to have someone with your pedigree and your experience to come on here and say what you're saying, I hope that that's more impactful than hearing it from a couple of psychologists who do this for a living.
No, I mean, knowing that you are out there delivering this message that you are describing right now to your athletes, it's just like, it like fills my heart. It feels like an honor to just be speaking with you today. This is I feel it's just like I'm so enjoying this. We would love to have you back.
Well, I would love to be back too. And the athletes would call this gassing each other up when you really are very complimentary. And I learned that phrase, and I was like, wow, that sounds like a really good phrase to do that. But I really appreciate your listening to me about this stuff. If I had to add one more thing, as an area potentially for future exploration, it would be about the Olympics and how so many people that arrive at the Olympics can either get to that point and are incredibly enthused and it sets up their life for everything amazing afterwards. But then there are also people that make the Olympics and realize, you know, a month later, wow, I'm back to being myself. And it hasn't changed their lives. Mm-hmm. And in some ways, when they strive and fail, and they actually, the Olympics creates an enormous hole in their soul for as long as possible, that it takes them years to fill. And it seems so strange from a mortal athlete to see these athletic, you know, titans go and do this. That they could be deeply negatively impacted by reaching that level. So I think there's something that is worthwhile for us to explore, that, you know, even at the highest level, your phrase, the poison pill, makes perfect sense to me. Mm-hmm. But I wouldn't say to somebody, don't go for the Olympics, but I would say go for the Olympics and make sure that you're enjoying the process of getting there, and, you know, that you're going to do this thing with, you know, as much wide open emotion as possible, whether or not it's success or failure. So,
yeah, no, thank you for raising that. And we've been fortunate enough to have some Olympic athletes on our podcast in the past who have spoken to some of that. And I think it's this broader issue too of striving and what it creates. And so, yeah, oh gosh, we would love to have you back on to talk about this some more. Thank you for bringing that up. And can you call it gassing someone up if you're telling the truth, though? That kind of feels like we're just blowing hot air. And it's like, I am genuinely inspired here by what you're saying. And so I'm not trying to inflate your ego. I'm like, damn, this guy, I'm not a rower and I would love to row for this guy. Right. Like, so, I mean, that's kind of how I feel right now. Well, to that end, as we wrap up here, you know, obviously we introduced you, you're the head women's coach at Penn. If anyone would like to reach out to you, any top rowing prospects who are looking for a phenomenal coach out there, any place to direct people? I don't know if you have any social media or anything you're comfortable sharing for people to connect.
Sure. We're primarily using Instagram for that. So at Penn Women's Rowing is definitely the handle to reach out to us. We're trying to share what we do with a fun twist on it. So hopefully it'll be entertaining for anybody who goes on there as well.
Fantastic. Well, you got at least one other follower in here now. Now that I've got that, I'm definitely going to check it out. And for anyone out there who's interested in connecting with us, with our MSPE Institute, we also have an Instagram page and a Facebook page and our website, mindfulsportperformance.org. Our podcast has an Instagram page as well. The handle is @mindful_sport_podcast. And we have our YouTube channel where we have all of our exercises that we kick our episodes off with. So the one that Tim led today, if you are looking for a great free library of meditations led by ourselves and experts from all over the world, I highly recommend checking out our YouTube channel. And you can connect with me, Dr. Keith Kaufman, on Instagram or on Twitter. And my handle is @mindfulsportdoc at both. Our book is still out there, Mindful Sport Performance Enhancement, Mental Training for Athletes and Coaches. And we always appreciate ratings, reviews for our book or for our podcast. And our podcast has a new feature this year where if you are kind enough or interested in supporting us to help offset some of the costs that we incur, you can do that through our Buzzsprout page. And there will be a link to that in our show notes. So thank you again, Wes, for joining us. Thank you to everybody who listened. Thank you to our dear colleague, Dr. Carol Glass, for all of her support behind the scenes, and to our producer, Taylor Brown, and Wes's colleague, Taylor Brown, for all of his work. And we'll see you all next time.
Thanks, everybody.